remembering.
Okay. All right. So I'm very happy to be here. As Mandy said, my name is Mike Amundsen, and this is how you find me. This is how you find me on LinkedIn and Twitter and all sorts of other places. I would love to connect with you and learn what you're working on and what's interesting to you in your projects as well. So I'm very lucky to work in a group called API Academy. Several of us are here this year at API Days, and we're sponsored by CA. So CA has a booth, and we'll also be spending some time at a small table. I would love for you to just to come up and talk to me and tell me what you're working on. It's a fun group. So I have had the pleasure of being here several times over the years and talked about several things. The 50 years of computing, Mechanical Turks, this idea about 100 years back to the information age a century ago. And last year, I got to talk about how AI and robots are affecting work and the future of work. So I really enjoy this conference very much. It's an opportunity for me to think about things and share and get some great ideas. I'm also very excited that the theme this year is sustainable software, sustainable society. We know lots about sustainability in IT, all the way to saving energy for the devices that we use, actually creating devices out of recycled materials and recycling those same materials. There is even a model for green software, for making sure that we are able to reuse not just the hardware, not just the materials, but also the software itself. In fact, there's a rather nice book about sustainable software development by Kevin Tate. I like this book because it goes beyond just the software and talks about the people and the organizations and how you sustain teams and lots of other things besides just the software itself. But what I'd like to do today, is we have a little bit of time, is to go back to the roots of this word sustainability in the modern age, why we talk about this idea of the intersection of profit, people, and planet, and how that's been applied over the last 30 years to the physical world, and see if we can get us to start thinking about how we can apply it to the virtual world as well. In order to do this, I've asked a friend of mine, Alex Rivera, who's a fantastic, talented US-based artist, to draw some images for me. So we're going to do this a little bit differently. We're going to kind of go on a little bit of a journey. So a few years ago, I did a talk that was very similar to this. It was this story about a character that went from the simple town through a magical forest to find this place where computers and humans interacted together. And it was called The Hypermedia Tale. You can find it online if you're interested. And it was also provided to me by another artist. At the end of that story, I actually said that it wasn't really the end. There was really more to it. And it turns out that this talk is about the other pieces that I hadn't been able to mention at that time. In fact, the cities that were involved in that story are part of a much larger community that is known as Omniterra, all the known world. There are lots of places in this space. So not just the story that I told a few years ago, but several other stories that I'd like to share with you today and use those as examples of how we can talk about sustainability. So the first place I want to start is probably the last place in the map. It's actually the ruins of Vanalindia, this place where there used to be this grand city, but it has now been left for ruins. And it's a rather impressive place when you visit it. It's this vast city that looks so great from afar. Actually, if you were far away, you would think the city is still alive. But as you get closer, you see there are lots of things in ruins, lots of carts and buildings left undone, the roofs caved in. But you could tell that it was once a really fantastic place. In fact, this used to be the center of this known world. People from all over came and traded and learned and shared all sorts of other things. It was sort of the place to be in this world. And it had a rather unusual aspect to it. The kings were architect kings. As each king ascended the throne, the king would create new plans for the entire city and rebuild the entire city in that king's image, the most modern, the most fantastic, the most high-tech that it could possibly be. And as the king unveiled all these plans and began to rebuild parts of the city, there was always some part of the city that wasn't working, that was being torn down, another that was being built. And this happened over and over. And you can imagine, as more and more kings ascended, the city became bigger and bigger, and it became a bigger and bigger job to rebuild this from the ground up, until finally, at one point, it would take so long to rebuild the city that the king would be dead before the project was completed. But that's okay, we'd have another king, we'd start again and again and again, and we would simply rebuild everything over and over until it got to the point where nothing worked. Nothing was functional, because everything was being rebuilt or torn down again. And eventually people had to move away. The city was unusable, and it was left for ruins, and they moved out into the countryside. And that's a key story that we need to think about. What happened was we kept rebuilding and rebuilding and rebuilding and just throwing away what we already had. And it turns out that that's not very sustainable over time. To simply start again and start again is not a good idea. So let's go back and talk about sustainability. The modern usage of the term, this idea of sustainability in the environment and incorporation, really comes from a thing called the World Commission on Environment and Development from 1987, about 30 years ago. Then Prime Minister of Norway, Gro Harlem Brundtland, led a committee and created this report, which is now published as Our Common Future, which is a great small book. I encourage you to read it. And laid out this notion of what sustainable development is. It meets the needs of the present without compromising the opportunities in the future. That's a really challenging way to think about it. How can we meet the needs of today without compromising what happens in the future? But in fact, this idea of sustainability goes way, way farther back. Almost 600 years ago, there was this gardener by the name of John Evelyn. And he created this notion that since we use wood for so many things, that we needed to take care of the forest, take care of the trees. And he wrote this book called Silva about forest trees and how to maintain and sustain timber. And that's why we have forestry today, or when we study forestry today. This notion that timber was this precious resource that we had to constantly maintain. And there were lots of versions of this around the same time, around the end of the 17th century, start of the 18th century, this idea that we needed this sustainability. So the challenge is we have to think about the future in some sort of way. We have to be prepared. We can't just do something just for today if we want it to be sustained. So how do we plan for the unknown? How do we make sense of something that's not here yet? Someone who had a great way to talk about this is Mel Conway. He wrote this paper about 50 years ago about how people invent and how the virtual world works, how people work together. And he has this great observation that as soon as you make a delegation, if you make a decision about something, you're cutting off other opportunities. The minute I decide who's on a team, then we're limited to the skills of who's on that team. The minute I decide not to use a particular product or to use some other product, there are all sorts of things we can no longer do. Each step, each decision affects our future. And that becomes really, really powerful. Another pair of individuals, Tom and Mary Cavendish, who brought the idea of lean software from manufacturing into software, have a slightly different way. They encourage you to delay your commitment until the last responsible moment. How can we put off decisions until the last responsible moment so that we don't cut off too many opportunities? And they have this nice twist to it. They have this idea that so that if it turns out not deciding eliminates possibilities, now that's probably the responsible moment. So this notion of sustainability, it turns out, has a lot to do with time. We need to use time to our advantage. Often time is this difficult thing for humans to grasp. Like, we don't really estimate time very well. We don't remember the past very well. We sort of imagine the future in a sort of a quirky way. It's hard to have a shared future. But time is really important. So this idea of time and time passing is really opportunity for us to talk about another place on the map. And that place is actually what's called the Salt Caves of Persistence. So there's these caves up in the north where there are people who actually live, and they store all the valuable things from the city. So people would come and they would collect up all of their valuables, and they'd take them out to the caves to the monks who would store them in all these locations. And the monks of Persis had this ability to understand just what objects were, to label them, to categorize them, to put them all in the right place. And every time there was an event, a family event, a wedding, or a celebration of some type, people would come out and they would ask the monks to retrieve all their things so that they could enjoy them for a few days for a festival, and then put them all back in the caves again. And as the city grew larger and larger, the caves had to be expanded as well. And there were monks whose only job was to simply move things around inside the caves. Some never even saw the light of day. They were called the dark monks. But they kept everything for us, and they kept everything available to us. Now, sometimes people never ask for those things back for all sorts of reasons. Maybe they had forgotten they were there. Maybe the family died, and no one took care of the extra things. But the monks never threw those things away. They might put them in another place in the caves, sort of like cold storage, something like that. But they would never take them away. So as the caves grew more and more vast, there were some monks that just spent all their time moving things about in the end. But they always had this place, they always had this interface, this way to hand things over to others. They kept what was valuable close at hand. And they didn't decide to throw things away just because nobody needed them now, because they were thinking about the future as well. And there are lots of things we can learn from this notion about planning for the future and how we store valuable things. Often this is expressed as this idea of profit in the profit people planet model. In fact, the profit people planet model comes from a gentleman by the name of John Elkington. So John Elkington was actually active on the Brundtland Commission, and he had this idea about how we could turn the commission's mandate about our common future into something tangible. So he created what was called the triple bottom line, TBL, sometimes 3BL. And that means not just dealing with the economic value, but also the environmental value and the social value. And these can help us a lot when we think about the virtual world as well. Elkington said we need all three of these in order to make sense of what we're doing. We need to understand the economic element, which we're pretty good at. But we also need to understand the social element, which we don't pay a lot of attention to often, but we're not too bad. And we need to think about the environment. And the trouble with thinking about the environment is very indirect. It's very long-term. So we have to make these balances. We have to make these trade-offs. It turns out it's difficult to trade one for the other. You have to make lots of sort of tough decisions along the way. So it turns out being effective and being efficient are not the same things, right? An efficient set of storage, the monks would throw things away after a certain amount of time. They wouldn't even care about them anymore. They might store everything as the same. They might put everything in one place. But effective means that it's still valuable, it's still useful, it lasts a long time. So it turns out sometimes these two things conflict with each other. Being incredibly thorough or being incredibly effective or efficient are often in conflict. And it turns out Eric Holnagel, who's a kind of a popular person in the DevOps world, talks about this a great deal. He even wrote a book called The Efficiency Thoroughness Trade-Off. Every day we make decisions about, should I be very thorough or should I just be quick and easy? In fact, in software, we ask our bosses this all the time. Do you want it right, or do you want it on time? Right? We make these questions every day. How I get to work, how I get to work on the train, or if I'm in the U.S., I drive, or whatever the case may be, I'm constantly making these decisions. And every once in a while, those decisions turn out badly. I always take the train, but I decide to drive today, and I get in a car accident. Right? It turns out badly. That's not my fault. I was just making the same decision I always make. So it's important to think about this idea of trading off. And trading off often means that we have to think ahead. And sometimes the decisions we make won't be correct. I love this quote from George Box, who is a statistician that just died recently, just a few years ago. And he has this great line, "All models are wrong, but some are useful." One of the big challenges that we have is the models that we have about the way the world works, the physical world, the virtual world, they're not always correct, and often they have to change. Changing our models is something very, very difficult, especially when we write software, because often we write software with one model in mind. So creating sustainable software often means figuring out how I can create a way that other models that are not mine, could actually be applied and be used.
So there's a line that I shared about a year ago. We were just talking about it last night. A bunch of us were together. And that is, the models in software, the model for your data is not the model for your objects, right? And the model for your objects is not the model for your API resources. And the model for your resources is not the message that you pass back and forth. Each one of these are independent elements. And if you can think about them independently, you can do the same thing that Huckabee was talking about. You can put off decisions until later. You can change the message model without affecting the data model. You can change the object model without worrying about the resource model. You can create these elements where I can decide later. And deciding later gives us that chance to sustain the design that we have a little bit longer. So what we're focusing on is not just the short-term ability to create a profit or to create something that's efficient, but also the long-term effectiveness, the actual value built into our network, the value built into our software. And that's really a tough challenge. So this notion of finding the value in our models being different leads us to the next place on our map. This is another place called the, we're going to visit the Scholars of Agregado. This is a community where people sort of are the engine of knowledge. People are the engine of learning. The Scholars of Agregado are rather peculiar. They're sort of savants. They each know something very special, and they're very good at it, and they can recall information very quickly. But the challenge is, the information that they know is not always useful by itself. It needs to be added to others. So there's this community where everyone has this special knowledge, but the real skill they have is this ability to work together as a team to solve a problem. And there's this marketplace where people can come and go and mix and ask questions, and they gather up little groups of people and sort of talk amongst themselves and pass information along until finally they get to the answer they need. It's this collaborative, cooperative experience. And it's this market, it's not just a marketplace of ideas, but it's a marketplace of knowing. And their ritual for putting all this together is known there in the Scholars of Agregado as the Dance of Knowing. All the processes, all the things that we put together, all adds up to understanding something. And that really leads us to the second element in Elkington's model, the people element. People are incredibly important. In Elkington's model, in the sustainability model that comes from the Brundtland Commission and others, this is the social variable. This is education and equity and access to resources and well-being and quality of life and social capital, all these other things that are really difficult to quantify. Who really has access to information? Who can get access to a computer? Who has access to a job? Who has access to healthcare? All these things kind of fall into place. And we have the same challenges in the virtual world as well. Who has the tools? Do we all have open source tools? Do some people have better tools than others? These are all things that add up. There's a great story that former President Barack Obama was visiting Silicon Valley a few years ago and kind of being lectured to about, you know, how we would do it in Silicon Valley. This is not a tough problem. We know how to solve problems there. And he had this great observation. He said, you know, government's never going to run like a startup or like Silicon Valley, because democracy itself, putting people into the mix, is messy. It's not predictable. It's not deterministic. And he said, part of government's job is dealing with the things that nobody else wants to deal with. He said, you know, if my only job was to create one app and I didn't have to worry about the people who couldn't afford it, my job would be easy. But he said, that's not my job. The app is the country, and my users are everyone. And that's a much harder job. I can't eliminate someone. One of the challenges in software is there are lots and lots of people who aren't included in the equation. We don't care about them, that they can't afford it, that they don't have access to it. And that happens even inside the organization as well. We don't often think about people as individuals, empowered and enabled individuals. We think of them as resources, as elements that we can use in some sort of way. And that can also be very challenging. So this idea in the community where we have this dance of knowing, this is what we have in every team. We have this notion where we can collaborate and we can share and we can think. But if you design an organization where you're mostly competing against one another for a job, mostly competing against other teams, collaboration isn't rewarded very much at all. It turns out we're connected in fundamental ways. Fundamental ways that we forget, that are easy to forget because they're not so tangible. Computers and networks teach us about that connection. Social media teaches about that. The World Wide Web teaches us about that. But it's difficult to live that life every single day. I want to quote one of my ABI Academy colleagues on this. The structure of our company, the way we actually communicate, affects the things that we build. If we're collaborative, it's easier to build collaborative products and collaborative tools. If we're competitive, it's harder to see the advantage of building something that others can use without asking, where others can participate without coming to us first, where we aren't the gateway, we're not the only source, where we empower people that we've never actually met before. But that becomes incredibly powerful. I'm going to go back to Mel Conway. Sort of the key thesis of Mel's understanding about the way committees and groups work 50 years ago was this notion that organizations that design systems that are a copy of the way they communicate. So the way we treat each other, the way we create teams, the way we interact with the community is all going to affect what we create. And what we create is going to affect that community. It turns out the group as a whole is more important than any one individual. Groups are incredibly powerful. Groups can embody a great deal of knowledge. But that group gets its characteristics from each person. It turns out if I change the team, if I have a team that works on the user front, and I change the team, I put someone else on the team, that's a different team. That's not just another resource plugged in. That's a different team, and that's going to affect the product itself. And that really that reminds me of this idea of the Theseus paradox. Theseus was this ancient mariner who was traveling the Mediterranean, traveling the seas, and he was gone for so long that he had to keep repairing his ship, and he would keep adding new wood to the ship and replace a plank and replace a board and replace the mast and replace the keel. And by the time he got home on his long voyage, he had replaced every single part of his ship with another piece of wood. So the question is that the same ship that left? Or is that an entirely different ship? And that's what people are like inside an organization. As you create things that sustain and enable and empower people, you have to be ready for the notion that they change, the complexion of the organization in fundamental ways. If you want the organization to be incredibly predictable, people are not very helpful, because people have their own. Change is inevitable. So when we build systems and interact with systems, they're actually not static, they're dynamic. They change. And change is really, really important. There's another place in the known world where change is actually the way things work, and this is called the Valley of the Metamorphs. The Valley of the Metamorphs is a very, very peculiar place. It's populated with lots of abstract sculptures. Nobody knows how they got there or how they were created. They look like they're chiseled out of stone, but actually they're smooth to the touch. They feel almost plasticky, but they're cold. Nobody knows how they got there or what they're made of, but the story is they change themselves over time. They actually morph into other shapes, into other objects. Nobody knows why. Some people think it has to do with the environment or the surroundings. Maybe there are certain people that interact with them in some kind of way, and for that reason they end up changing shapes and changing aspects of one another, but nobody's sure. Some people even think that's sort of an imagination, that if you watch long enough, there's nothing that happens. But it turns out they change ever so imperceptibly over a long period of time until eventually, if you sort of check over history, you realize, I didn't understand, but it actually is changing. There actually are differences. And nobody knows how this process works. But it seems like in the valley, change is constant. Not only is it inevitable, but it's constant. And that leads us to the third and final pillar of Elkington's story, the planet. So again, to quote Elkington, he talks about this notion where companies endeavor to benefit the natural order as much as possible, to minimize their effect on the environment, especially their negative effect on the environment. And that reminds us again about Gro Harlem Brundtland and what her commission talked about. The environment and development are the same thing. They're inseparable. There's an old joke that there was a spill in the ocean, and it was polluting things. And somebody said, well, what are you doing about it? I said, well, we're going to tow it out of the environment to tow it somewhere else. Right? So then it won't be harming things. Well, of course, you can't do that, right? Because the environment is everywhere. We are the environment. And we are responsible for everything that we build and we do over time. In fact, the great law of the Iroquois, the American Iroquois, has this notion of seventh generation stewardship. I think seven generations into the future as to how what I'm going to do today will affect that future. I'm focused on the future even just as much as I am today. And this takes us back to the original notion about how we might do that. That's a real challenge in the software world, in the IT world. It turns out that change is not just a discrete jump from one thing to another. It's often very, very incremental. And these incremental changes are why software breaks, why things don't work the way we thought of. We call them bugs, right? Because I didn't expect that to happen when these things interacted. And as we build larger and larger software, this becomes more and more common because there are more and more things that we can't predict. Now, just recently, within the last few years, we've talked a lot about how we can deal with change and how we can deal with the way things change. This Sam Gibson from ThoughtWorks wrote this great piece called Monoliths Are Bad, right? Because now we have a name for them. That thing that we used to do is bad, but this is going to be good, right? And he talks about this idea of making change happen faster. I actually kind of prefer the notion of making change happen more safely. Right? Because change happens all the time. We are our own feces paradox, right? All the cells in our body change over time. Are we the same person we were 5 years ago? Last year when I was here, I had a beard. That's all gone. Am I the same person? And the planet changes. And everything else changes as well. And inside a corporate ecosystem, things change. One of the more challenging aspects of Elkington and this notion of sustainability is thinking about this cooperation between suppliers and customers, stakeholders, and even competitors. Amazon talks about this notion of actually hosting the competitors on their platform as a way to create a closer connection to all things. And this idea of stakeholders and connections leads us to the last place that I want to visit on this map today, and that's a place called Mount Roy, this peak that sort of sticks out of the valley. So, this is an amazing place. This is an incredibly difficult, craggy peak that everyone wants to make a pilgrimage to. There's supposed to be this giant Maori man sitting at the top of this mountain, this all-knowing, all-seeing man that has the answers to all questions. And people sort of revere the notion that this man exists. So they constantly make this trek up to the mountains. But it turns out it's very arduous. It's very difficult. And in fact, several people never make it to the top. They actually just sort of stop along the way, disgruntled and disappointed, and set up shop and sort of waylay passersby and say, no, no, there's no one at the top. There's actually just me. And they sort of like create their own little communities. And it turns out getting up there is really difficult. Now, there are stories that there's a smart man, a brilliant man, sometimes an angry man, sometimes even a lonely man working alone at the top. And what he's working on is this giant longboat where everyone can ride inside and has all sorts of symbols, all the symbols from all of the cities in the known worlds, as well as other cryptic elements. And then someday, he's going to come down from the top of this mountain and tell everyone about what this longboat means and what this means to the rest of the community. He has this idea where he can kind of see all things. But again, some people think he doesn't exist at all. So what does this mean? What does this tell us about sustainability? How can we turn our notions of sustainability into something meaningful for us today? How can we take these values from the physical world and bring them into the virtual world? There's this other quote that I really love from Dr. Donella Meadows. She and a team wrote a book called The Limits to Growth in the 1970s. This was 15 years before the Brundtland Commission, where she explained this notion how there's only so much we can keep growing to. And I love her line, running the same system harder or faster will not change the pattern as long as we don't revise the structure. We have to change ourselves. We have to change our point of view. We have to change the way we build software, the way we think about connecting to the communities. This is what we have to do. So let's go through these three steps again and think about them from our own standpoint, from the IT standpoint. If you're an IT company, you need to focus on value, not just profit. Profit is short-term. Value is long-term. That can be incredibly challenging. If you're an NGO or a nonprofit company, you have to make sure that you align the IT with your own company values. Are you using software that actually doesn't promote your values? Are you using software just because? Is it really making a difference in your community? And as users, we have to question the value of what we give away, all our personal data, all our behavioral information, for what we get in return. Are we actually getting something important? And if, in the case of people, in the second leg, and that companies need to empower people and enable communities, enable groups, in order to make their own decisions, provide them principles. NGOs need to make sure that IT serves and not demands. Are we doing it just because that's the way the computer does it, or do we have software that actually really allows us to meet our goals in our community? And for consumers, we need to be aware of how our labor-saving devices actually work. Who's building these devices? What conditions are they building them under? When I have this cool little feature where it automatically does something for me, is there some human, some mechanical Turk behind the scenes actually solving this problem for almost nothing, just for my convenience? So we have a responsibility there as well. And planetary level means that we have to leverage change and not fight it. Change is a feature, not a bug. We need to build change into what we do. We need to take responsibility for the environment we create, and we have to own it. And finally, we have to take note about how the tech that we use affects people around us. Are there people right next to me that have no access to this information? Well, how much privilege do I actually exercise, and how much does what I'm doing actually impact the environment around me? Not just physically, but also virtually, in terms of sharing ideas and allowing people access and clear and open debate and the opportunity to speak their mind. Am I enabling that, or am I actually making that more difficult? So meeting the needs without compromising the future. That's the kind of software that we can sustain over time. Now, I just want to mention a couple more things, and then we'll be done. Chamath Priyapathy has this idea. He used to work at Facebook, and he has this notion. He said recently that social media is eroding the core foundations of how we behave by and between people. Social media, it turns out, may not be sustainable. It may be profitable. Maybe people are making a great deal of money on what we're sharing. But it may not sustain healthy communities. And in fact, this ability to sustain healthy communities is starting to drive a wedge into Silicon Valley. There's a sort of a divide between what's healthy and what's not. Larry Fink, who runs the BlackRock investment group, $6.3 trillion worth of wealth. I'm not crazy, it's a crazy number. And he was just at Davos recently, and he's made this statement. Society is demanding that companies serve a social purpose. This takes us back to the way the Brundtland Commission was talking 30 years ago today. Serving a social purpose becomes really, really important. The software we build, the software that we share, is really a social purpose. So when investors start talking about this, this is probably important. So we've already seen today there are great things we can do right here. They're right here in the building. So programmed obsolescence, giving people an opportunity to express their views safely, connecting people with technology, reducing the amount of waste, and the whole notion of sharing all together. These are all examples right here in France that you can get involved with today. And there are lots and lots of other examples around the globe as well. We're incredibly lucky. We have this opportunity to affect so much change. And it can be a tough journey. It can be tough to try to make that climb. It seems like it's so much easier to take the short-term profit, the short-term benefit, ignore the people that don't have access, not take Barack Obama's example and think that everybody always takes everything to heart. So there are lots and lots of challenges, but there are also lots and lots of opportunities to improve things. And this could be a great start in the software community to think about sustainability the way we think about it in the physical world. This notion of profit, people, and planet. And hopefully, as we learn about all the places around us, all the opportunities we have, all the places we can go, this gives us more and more opportunity to create sustainable software and to meet the challenge of those seven generations that the Iroquois talk about. And that's what I have. I hope I get a chance to talk with you more this week. Thank you very much. Thank you.